the House State Affairs Committee to order at 3 p.m. on January 28th. Madam Secretary, can you call the roll, please?
Representative Story?
Present.
Representative Thompson?
Here.
Representative Vance?
Here.
Representative Shaw?
Here.
Representative Hopkins?
Here.
Representative Fields?
Here.
Representative Christ-Tompkins?
Here.
Okay, we have a quorum to do business. Please silence your cell phones. And first up on the agenda today is HJR 15. This is the third hearing in House State Affairs, and I believe the sponsor, Representative Christ-Tompkins, and perhaps his staff will make remarks, and that'll be followed by some invited testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jonathan Christ-Tompkins, District 35, Rural Southeast Alaska. Just here for questions or comments that the committee might have.
Seeing no questions at this time, I believe we will go to public testimony. I think we have invited testimony from former Speaker Mike Breitner.
Thank you, members of the committee, for being able to avail myself of this opportunity. For the record, my name is Michael Bradner, and I live at 3037 South Circle in Anchorage. And I'm here basically at your invitation and some trepidation because I'm a writer, and you hesitate to be both, a writer, a news writer, and a newsmaker. And that's what you are when you sit at this table. But I had opportunity, Mr. Co-Chairs, to serve and know a lot of our constitutional founders. I was a news reporter in Fairbanks in the early 60s, and there were lots of questions about vagaries in our Constitution and what it meant. So I had the privilege of interacting with a lot of our constitutional founders and serving with some. And I think probably few of them would have ever imagined that the veto could be used in the manner it has been, reaching back in time and, eliminating whole programs. Generally, over the years, my experience, the veto has been exercised to deal with issues out of the current legislature and sometimes, on occasion, reaching back in time and touching on programs that governors question. But I think we sort of have a constitutional crisis, and I think it reaches beyond this legislature, and it's really bipartisan in nature. What this governor can do, any other governor can do, and that can bring some problems down the line. The flavor of politics changes, and as I read it, I mean, a governor could veto things like our oil tax credits. And as time changes, the tipping of social spending and also development spending changes. And we don't know what is in front of us in the next generation. We're going to be under a lot of pressure of climate change and a lot of different issues. But what concerns me is it's not just the three-quarter vote. It's the three-quarter vote burdened by very small legislative bodies. And it requires only securing 16 votes to override. And I would say as an old presiding officer and for 4 years as a rules chairman, if you can't secure the votes to prevent an override, you ought not to be governor. Because you're no politician. And that also has come up in an interesting venue in the case that of the Alaska contribution level that went to the Supreme Court and was kicked back to the appeals court. And Justice Ginsburg attached a statement to that citing our small legislative bodies and possible vulnerability to corruption, also given our narrow revenue base. And I think that's interesting, and I think it's something that we need to be concerned about. It's not just the three-quarter vote. It's a three-quarter vote in our small legislative bodies and the regional share, you know, spread of our bodies to where it's very easy to sort of, you know, intimidate different regions and put legislators in a very difficult situation of exercising the prerogative to override. And also, I would stress that you people, you're the people's branch. And this, you know, let me use a term that comes out of literature and past opinions, the tyrannical aggrandizement of power by one branch over another. And this is a term that appears in our legal literature. It appears also going straight back to our founding of our Constitution, Madison and Hamilton, who used the term in trying to convince the various colonial assemblies that separation of powers protected them from their president being just a substitution for the tyrant that they had overthrown. And I wrote a piece and I referred to the governor as a tyrant in that context. And I said, well, I share that title. In the mid-70s, as Speaker of the House, and we had a young legislature, and we questioned a lot of the lines of authority between the legislature and the governor. And one of them was confirmation power. How far would our confirmation power reach? And so we decided that we would pass a statute and then we would sue the governor, which we did. And Justice Rabinowitz, in a rather lengthy opinion, informed us that we may not encroach by one inch, and that used the term that I just cited. So I suppose I share that title with the governor. He's a tyrant if I call him that, and so am I. So I think we really have to think about the invasion of the prerogatives of the legislature. And I think the governor, I mean, he was a new governor, and I think there were people who influenced him to perform in the way he did. And it appears now he's trying to moderate that intensity. So, but still, I mean, I would hope this could become a bipartisan bill, because I think it reaches far beyond the partisanship, which is fairly acute, that we now face. You know, that will change. But it really involves both parties and many issues that will be issues to both parties over time. And I think we face some issue in the next decade where we're going to need to be together and we're not to be separated like we are now. And I mean, I suppose I could stop there and ask, let the committee ask questions if they wish.
Thanks, Mr. Bradner. Do members of the committee have questions?
Yes.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I have some questions here. What I'm looking for is good governance. And when it comes to constitutional amendments and any changes to our state constitution, we need to make sure that that movement going forward is going to work for the next 50, 100, 200 years. Because it's our state constitution, it's our guidebook. But what I've heard you speak to is more of the politics. I'm looking for good governance, because while you speak to the tyranny and certain positions on one side of this issue in this particular governor, there is another side. And if we're supposed to work together for the good policy, doesn't that come through better communication rather than lowering the voting threshold? Because that would be by a lower majority guiding the conversation. So I'm asking you, what do you feel is good governance without looking at this current political climate?
Well, I think this political climate only demonstrates the difficulty in governance, that your prerogatives have been invaded by the governor. We can argue about that and have differences of opinion about that. But basically, I mean, most states have a two-thirds override. And I think the original intent of separation of powers was that, you know, the executive branch could not intimidate the legislative branch. And I think a three-quarter vote with our regionalism and so on, absolutely, whether it's today's politics or tomorrow's politics, really is invasive of the governor's or the legislature's ability to legislate. And you're the people's body politic. And it's messy at times. I mean, I've often called the legislature sort of the garbage can because that's where the public brings their issues and you fight it out. And the public sometimes gets frustrated because, you know, you're really not one legislature, you're two. You're a House, you're a Senate, you're many committees. And, you know, so the public hears this kind of commotion and they feel like, you know, the legislature gets criticism, perhaps it isn't due. But I absolutely think that, you know, good governance requires that the legislature have reasonable opportunity to override a governor's veto. And in this case, I think it's almost impossible. Do I answer your question? Maybe not.
Thanks. And just to be clear for folks who are tuned in to provide public comments, we're going to have public comments on this bill, and I see some folks are in the queue, and we're also going to have public comments on the next bill, House Bill 187. Representative Shaw had a question.
I guess my question relates to a comment that you made about intimidation from the governor. And if we lower the standards, don't we have a majority that intimidates the minority?
I'm not sure quite what you mean by that, but that's the standard of most states. And basically, the executive branch is in charge of administrating the statutes and really, you know, in any fashion isn't entitled to intimidate the legislative process. That's your process. That's how you respond to the public. And no, I mean, I think, you know, we're sort of at a point here that we got to make some decisions.
Okay. Thank you. I believe we have some folks online for public testimony. Mike Coons, are you online and are you calling to testify on HJR 15?
Yes, this is Mike Coons from Palmer, and I'm speaking for myself. I oppose HJR 15. And talking to Representative Christ Thompson's staff on this bill, I was told the reason for this bill is because all other states have a two-thirds threshold for veto overrides. I looked it up. The truth is, and I got this from ballotpedia.org, that veto overrides, in the veto margin required to override a veto varies by state. 36 states require a two-thirds, 7 require 3/5, 6 states require a simple majority, and of course Alaska with 3/4. Of additional interest is that 22 states, as of November 2018, have a veto-proof majority. Yes, Alaska is the only one with a 3/4 vote, and I'm glad that our founding fathers, in writing the state constitution, did so. Obviously, the founders did not look upon the governor as a tyrant or call the office of the governor an office of a tyrant as an insult to our republic. Remember, we are a republic, not a democracy. What this boils down to, in my opinion, this is nothing more than an attempt to make it easier to override a strong governor who is keeping spending or attempting to keep spending under control. These last attempts at overriding Governor Dunleavy's line item vetoes were a failure. Even this last attempt would have failed by one vote if two legislators were, and if two legislators were there, it would have failed by three. The person that is testifying for this is making this about this governor by a bill that would impact decades, if not longer, of other governors. The governor has constitutional amendments that this committee has refused to bring forward that would have far better impact on the people of Alaska. I call on Representative Christ Thompson to bring forward those bills and stop trying to undo what was and is the best way to stop overspending. I will take any questions.
Thanks, Mr. Coons. Laura Bonner is next in the queue. Ms. Bonner, are you online?
Good afternoon. I wanted to testify on House Bill 187.
Great. Please stand by, and we'll get to that bill next soon, I hope. Okay, Adam Hikes, are you online, and do you want to testify on HJR 15?
I am here, and I would like to testify to House Joint Resolution 15.
Okay, please go ahead.
I am against this. I would strongly say no to this resolution. I voted for the governor in the past election, and it's really hard to see this as a way to not cover for the attempts last session to override his vetoes when there weren't enough legislators present at an unauthorized special session in Juneau when the governor had clearly called the legislation constitutionally within his power to the valley up here in the interior. It's hard not to view this any other way, especially since the legislation has consistently fought against the governor. I see this resolution as a dangerous advance toward muddying the waters as far as separation of powers go in our state. And that's all I have to say.
Great. Thanks, Mr. Hikes, for calling in. Does the sponsor wish to make any closing remarks before we take action on this legislation? Okay. In that case, I move HJR 15 version 31-LS0862-M from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying zero fiscal note. Martha, could you call the roll?
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Representative Vance?
No.
Representative Shaw?
No.
Representative Hopkins?
Yes.
Representative Story?
Yes.
Representative Fields?
Yes.
Representative Christ Tompkins?
Yes.
5 yea, 2 nay.
That legislation will advance from committee, and we are going to take a brief at ease for folks to sign the paperwork.
We're back on the record, and for the record, this is Representative Christ Tompkins, now serving as chair. The second item of today's agenda is House Bill 187. This is the second hearing. As previewed by staff to Representative Jackson, Mr. Elijah Verhagen, last hearing, there was amendment forthcoming. The amendment deadline was 5 o'clock yesterday. There was one amendment received, several iterations thereof in circulation. And for that amendment, I'll turn to you, Representative Fields, for a motion.
Okay. I move Amendment 1, 31-LS1253-E6.
I'll object for discussion purposes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As the committee heard at our last hearing, this is an issue that Representative Jackson brought up, and I think that since we have so much consensus on this issue of keeping prisoners in state where they can have the strongest possible rehabilitation programs and prevent gangs from coming back to Alaska, I thought it was important to work with a member, even one not on the committee, to incorporate her ideas right from the start. And after several iterations of drafting, because some of this is more complicated than I initially would have guessed, you have the amendment in front of you. And again, this originated as my colleague's amendment. And I think the intention of it was to say, if in fact it is cheaper, and that's not certain, but in some cases perhaps would be true, if in fact it is cheaper to house a prisoner out of state in the case where the prisoner is going to serve a 99-year sentence or longer, essentially a life sentence, and that prisoner does not have family where the family visitation is important, say, for the emotional development of a child who lives in Alaska, then in those limited cases, the department would have the option of potentially housing this very limited population of prisoners. As I understand, it's 20 or fewer in the department. The department have the option of incarcerating them out of state. And I also want to note and thank Kelly Good from the Department of Corrections that there are a few existing prisoners who are already incarcerated out of state, very limited group of people. For example, if a police officer commits an offense and is incarcerated, they have to be incarcerated outside for safety reasons for that police officer. And nothing in this amendment and nothing in this bill inhibits the ability of the Department of Corrections to house that very limited population of prisoners out of state consistent with the Interstate Corrections Compact. And initially, I was thinking I would need to write an amendment to clarify that in consultation with legislative legal. It is not necessary because we're not altering the underlying statute related to the Interstate Corrections Compact. So just know that going forward, the Department of Corrections will continue to house a very limited population. I believe it's 11 people. Might change a little bit outside based on limited circumstances, i.e. a police officer who, for reasons of safety, couldn't be housed here. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions about this amendment.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question on, and it's probably a legal question, I'm not sure, but on page 2 of the amendment, line 27, imprisonment of 99 years or more, I'm not sure what the legal terms would be, but if somebody's imprisoned and if it's 99 years without parole, I can understand that. But if somebody's imprisoned and is sentenced to 99 years, how many years do they serve before that they're eligible to be up for parole? At least, you know, that doesn't mean they're going to get parole, but they could, is it 5 years later after being sentenced to 99 years that they can then go before the parole board? Or that's a question I have. I don't know who could answer that.
Representative Fields.
Thanks for that question, and certainly my understanding from the sponsor is that the intent is for people who will be incarcerated for life, and I guess I would also be curious in hearing from Ledge Legal just to make sure that we've drafted appropriately to ensure that this is, in fact, for lifers.
Well, we're in a bind because Legislative Legal isn't online if that was queuing them up, but Ms. Good or Mr. Verhagen, do you have perspective? Thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon, committee. My name is Kelly Good, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Corrections. So there's a lot that goes in through the chair, Representative Thompson. There's a lot to go into time calculation. So this is going to be very broad. But in general, if an inmate were to do as they should, right, do programming or whatever, there is good time available, which is a third. So you could think about that. That's just a broad overstated today just because there's so many different calculations that go into somebody's time calculation. But I'd say that that's pretty fair. If you were looking at a 99-year and somebody got a third off of, then you can do the math. But if that, so I guess you're looking at, we don't have life sentences, right? I mean, a judge doesn't say you're sentenced to life in Alaska. There's years. So I guess it would be determined on the age of that individual and the average lifespan of average. I can tell you, we look at it in the department when we use a very broad average of 78 years for, I believe it's for males, and that's, you know, that's not taking into every caveat. That's just a general, a lifespan is about a 78 years. So does that help a little bit?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Any other questions on amendment number one, Representative Hopkins?
I've got several. If somebody is sentenced over 99 years, and maybe this is a question for the sponsor of this part of it, would they automatically be moved out of state under this bill, or would it be a decision process at some point along the line?
I can answer that.
Representative Fields.
They would not be automatically sent outside. This gives the commissioner the option of doing that under certain circumstances, namely that it is, in fact, more cost-effective, taking into account the full range of costs for that limited population. It is not automatic.
So it would be just based on cost, more or less, not the type of crime?
It is currently written. It gives the commissioner the option if it is cheaper. Okay. That's not to say that she wouldn't take into account other factors, but those factors are not spelled out in the amendment.
Representative Hopkins?
Yeah.
Follow-up?
If they're not spelled out in the amendment, does that mean that it's at the discretion of the commissioner on an individual basis for person by person?
It is.
Okay. And then may I continue?
Yeah, thank Representative you. Hopkins.
If a person has their sentence reduced, there was an individual in Fairbanks recently who was sentenced to over 99 years for a crime, and I'm not sure the community ever wants to see that person back in the community, back at Fairbanks or in the state, but it was reduced to, I believe, 60-something years. Would that person then be moved back to Alaska and put in one of our prisons here?
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins, the way that this reads, I would say that we would probably consult law, but the sentence has changed and it's no longer a 99-year sentence, so it wouldn't be applicable at that point. So we'd have to review it. Yep.
You have to review it. So, okay.
Follow-up or additional question?
Additional questions. And here it also says if the resident is not if the prisoner is not a resident of the state, do we currently have anybody housed in Alaska who's not a resident of the state?
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins. So this is not our amendment, right? I will gladly get you that. We don't have a ton, but there are people that travel to Alaska and commit crimes, and then, you know, they may be incarcerated with us. I will gladly get you those numbers if you'd like, just so you could see the numbers of them. But I'm not expecting a large number when I pull them.
We'll follow up on that then. Do they serve the time where they did the crime?
Through the chair, yes.
Okay.
For the most part, yes.
What are the variables about?
Earlier said, we have like those 11 folks that are out of state, and I just don't want to say that it would never happen, right? But in general, we sentence the folks up here, you know, except for the 11 people right now that we have in different locations due to extenuating circumstances.
Additional question?
No, not yet. Thank you. Thank you for the allowance of freedom of the questions.
Of course, Representative Hopkins. Representative Vance.
Yes. I have a kind of a along the same lines of that, and I was wondering, Deputy Commissioner Good, if you could tell us what is the current policy for the decision to send inmates outside? Is there a kind of a threshold, a checklist on determining who those members would be versus who you would have in the state?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, if we're talking about how we handle it today, mm-hmm. there's a classification unit, and that unit looks at housing. When we are notified internally, usually, of maybe it's like Representative Fields mentioned, a police officer has committed a crime, and we do have someone out of state right now who was a former law enforcement. That we know about that, and we recognize that there may be security issues by housing them within the state due to their prior profession. And that classification unit's going to look at those things. They have a whole list of that they're going to go through. And then we work with other states through the compact that is in statute to find a suitable placement. So there is actually I can get you specifics, but the classification unit, there is literally a group of people that are always looking at best housing options for people, for inmates.
Follow-up. Well, based upon the amendment that we are specifically discussing, it has the 99 years, imprisonment of 99 years or more, and I think that's kind of where most of these questions are coming from, is to make sure that we have this right. And if you were to give a recommendation to fit the intent that Representative Jackson is coming from, do you think that the 99 years or more is the best way to word this in statute, or would you recommend other language that would fit the intent of what I know you can't speak for her intent, but from your position, what do you think would be the best assessment for this? I think we're all trying to get to those who are in our life and aren't going to continue to live in the community of Alaska, right? So is this the best way to describe that, to where we're not continuing to burden the state but also allowing flexibility?
Through the chair, Representative Vance. So thank you for giving me the caveat of not. I haven't ran this by the Department of, we have an attorney that I could always, you know, discuss this with. But math-wise, so I understand the intent of the representative as well, right? And so looking at math, and by knowing our average life expectancy, you're getting there, right? Because if someone is commits a crime at, let's just say, 20, because that would be an adult, so in our institutions, and they got all the good time in general, and again, we're being broad because there's different things to consider, that would still be probably over 60 years that they'd be serving. So that takes them over the anticipated average life span of 78 years. So if that's what the committee is looking for, so I don't want to speak for policy for you all. This is your call. But in general, when I'm looking at it, that's kind of the general math I see. So you're getting there. And I can tell you that Representative Fields is accurate. We did give him a number of about 200, a little over 200 people that would fall in that. Again, we had to kind of do some general math, right? Because not everybody gets convicted right at 19. Some of them get convicted much later. So you aren't, well, you actually would at 99 years. Yeah, so you are encompassing a lot of those folks, I would think. But I would be glad to continue to look at this later, no matter what the committee does today, and work with the sponsor as well. I mean, we understand the goal behind the amendment.
Thank you.
And Mr. Verhagen, if at any point you'd like to make comment, just let us know, and you can provide perspective as well, including right now.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Elijah Verhagen, staff to Representative Jackson. Through the chair, Representative Vance, the 99 years, as we just heard, is maybe not ideal language. And we did have another amendment that we drafted up, but we missed the deadline, and so we're respecting, you know, the committee and of the amendments. But we did have legal draft up another amendment that it didn't use a number of 99 years, but we tried to encompass language that was inclusive of. The intent of Representative Jackson is not to send prisoners out of state that will be re-released into Alaska, because we want to keep them here, and that's why we definitely support this bill. And so we had language in this other amendment that we were not able to meet the timeline that may or may not have better encompassed these 200 roughly people we're talking about. As opposed to putting the number 99 years, if that helps. And so it would be the will of, you know, obviously up to the committee if we were to bring this language up in another finance or the next committee it goes to, or in this committee. I know that that's obviously your guys' call, and I believe you could even write an amendment like here in committee if we take a break. I'm not saying that we should. That's your guys' call. I'm just saying that, yeah, we did not want or the 99 years might not be the best language for the amendment.
Sounds muddy. Muddy, yeah. Water.
Can we take an Addies?
Yeah, Addies. So I think a couple of facts to bear. Sounds like the amendment was not fully baked by the amendment deadline yesterday. I'm kind of a stickler about these things. Very clear, there's an amendment deadline. Do your homework by the deadline. If you don't have a fully baked product, tough luck. So we can take this amendment up for a vote now.
Further questions?
But it sounds like there's ample opportunity, and I think like good intent and good policy that can get incorporated down the process. But of course, it's ultimately the will of the committee what to do on this amendment. But before we get to
Chair.
A vote or anything. I represent Story and then Representative Thompson.
Oh, we're just voting on the amendment. I have some other questions on the bill. I realize you're just dealing with
Yeah, absolutely. We'll get back to the bill in a second, amended or unamended, depending on the will of the committee. Representative Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, I withdraw my objection to Amendment Number 1, Version E6, which puts it back to 90.
I'm going to object for purposes of clarification. So, Representative Fields, Amendment Number 1, as you moved it, Amendment Number 1, E.6, I'm trying to untangle whether...
Did I just summarize the amendment as it stands before you?
I have some further questions on the amendment as well.
Yeah, actually, let's just go to you, Representative Hopkins.
And this might be for the department. It comes down to the cost savings. How do we determine where we would save a cost? Is there a strict, Alaska has a sharing of prisoners agreement with other states, other prisons? Do we get to go pick that specific prison that costs less and do our research and find it just to save ourselves a few dollars versus keeping them in state where maybe they can be rehabbed? So that would be my first question. How do we find those lower cost prisons?
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins. So mind you that this isn't a department amendment. Okay. So how I see it would work, we'd have to create a policy in-house to deal with this. We know what our mandate cost is, right? You've heard us talk about $168.74 all last year, right, for an inmate per day. And so we know our cost. Our classifications unit, they have relationships with other states. We tend to work with state government prisons, right? And so they know what the costs are in different places, and so they would probably work that out. But like I said, we'd have to look at a policy. We'd have to actually draw this up in the department to make sure that we did have a guideline to follow in order to make sure that cost savings were realized, because it will be demanded by statute. So how that is exactly, I don't want to speculate, but we would do it the right way to ensure that should the legislature come forward and say, hey, these people that you have out of state, you know, did you follow statute? And is there a cost savings and what is it? We would want to be able to provide you that data.
Follow up. Are people who are sentenced to 99 years or more, is it always a violent crime? Are there other types of crimes that might not incarcerate somebody for 99 years? Or might incarcerate somebody for 99 years, like an excessive drug dealing crime or something like that? Or are they always violent?
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins, I don't want to speak on that one. We'd need an attorney. Unclassified felonies probably for sure get up to those numbers, and they're. But I don't know if conspiracy. I think conspiracy could be in an unclassified felony. I just don't know. I'd need to pull that for you. Gladly will, but I don't have that information unless the sponsor does.
I would appreciate that. I think that's integral to this decision. Thank you.
Further questions on Amendment Number 1, E.6 for Department of Corrections, amendment sponsor? Okay. At this point, Representative Fields, perhaps you could re-summarize Amendment Number 1, E.6.
Sure. Again, this amendment is following a long process with Ledge Legal, consistent with what Representative Jackson and her staff presented at the last hearing. And what this does is allow the Department of Corrections to have the option of housing a very limited subset of prisoners, namely those with extremely long sentences, 99 years or more, out of state, in the event that such out-of-state placement would in fact save money based on a reasonably comprehensive analysis. It does not mandate that the commissioner do that, nor does it prescribe certain groups which she could place out of state, nor does it alter the department's existing authority under the Interstate Corrections Compact.
All right. As the objector to Amendment Number 1, and with an understanding that there'll be further opportunity to develop this idea in the next committee referral, Finance, I'm going to remove my objection to Amendment Number 1, E.6. Is there any further objection to Amendment Number 1? Seeing and hearing none, amendment number one, E.6 passes. That was the only amendment submitted by the amendment deadline, which takes us back to the bill as amended as a whole. Representative Story, you said you had a question.
Yes, and I, you know, the more you read this, you can get it all mixed up in your head. But I appreciate the maker of the amendment. She is saying if there, the department has a discretion, if the person is not a resident, or if they are a resident and they have been sentenced to a term of more than 99 years, and if the parent, the prisoner is a parent, the prisoner does not have a child. So she's trying to be supportive of a person who has a long sentence but is an adult parent. So my question is, there are adult children who do crimes of passion, severe crimes, and should there be another line? And if the prisoner is, I mean, they might, isn't it, you know, they're like they're an adult child of people who are living in the state. I'm concerned about some crimes of passion that I know have happened in the state, and I know the department has discretion. I'm just wondering if the concern is about family ties, if there shouldn't be some language in there. And I have another comment, and that is the word parent, because some cases there's a guardian that is involved, and it's not the parent, but it's the guardian of a child who's under 18. And then there are also situations, cultural situations, where family members are an uncle who raises the child. And so when I look at the term parent, I know that if the situation is to protect the family unit, the language can seem limiting to me for those two circumstances.
And I want to limit committee to consideration of the bill to questions at this point and provide an opportunity for comment at the end. And Representative Stray, if there are questions for the sponsor or DOC, we can definitely take them now. But at this point, questions, any questions for sponsor or the agency? Representative Vance.
Clarification, we've moved to the entire bill now.
Entire bill, as yes. Amended.
Yes, I do have questions, Deputy Commissioner. I don't know why you sit way back every time. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. I'm looking at the fiscal note analysis that was provided on here, and I have concerns about this bill. I, as a member of the legislature, do want our prisoners to stay within the state for the same reasons as the maker of this bill. I think it is vital to the rehabilitation that we have our inmates become productive members of the community in however we can help them in this process. But I do have concerns that I think are expressed here on this fiscal analysis. It says if this legislation were passed, these prisoners would be required to remain within an Alaska prison and could jeopardize the safety and security of the staff, prisoners, and facility. And then on down it says it is unknown the full financial impacts that could result from facility overcrowding, increased staffing overtime, potential litigation, facility renovations and repairs, as well as other costs associated with identifying increased bed capacity. Therefore, an indeterminate fiscal note is being submitted. This is concerning, and I'd like you to elaborate on this if you can, so that we can know how to best proceed forward.
Through the chair, Representative Vance, again, Kelly Good, Deputy Commissioner of Corrections. So you asked pretty much two questions in that fiscal note. The first one about security issues, the sponsor of the bill addressed that in his amendment. So that's where we were worried about, would we be able to still take some of those security risks and work with other states. So that part of that fiscal note should change now with the new version.
Okay.
The second part, that is just an overall department view of having the available tools to manage the population as needed at the time. So when you read about overpopulation, right, having the ability, if necessary, to send folks out of state, it's a population tool. It's not to say that that's the choice and people want to do it. It's that if we're at overcapacity, rather than getting sued and rather than having facilities that may have security issues, that would be an available tool to look at and to use. Not to say that it necessarily would be, right? But that's why it's referenced in the fiscal note, is that we can't see all possibilities that could happen if population rose to a certain degree, but we wanted to make you aware that this is why the department as a whole always wants as many tools as possible to deal with. So that's why.
Follow up. So someone brought to my attention that there are many half beds available in halfway houses at about $90 a day. Does the department have flexibility to put some of the prisoners who are awaiting sentencing in these halfway houses to accommodate the capacity concerns and also the funding concerns? Do y'all have the flexibility to do that already?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, the department fully supports placing inmates in CRCs, halfway houses, as well as on EM. There are so many restrictions that also guide us in that. And some of those restrictions are municipal ordinances. Some of them are statute. Some of them are just the mere fact that one inmate qualifies for all of those, but we don't have a ton of inmates that qualify for any of those. Does that make sense? So one individual, pretty much think of them as a minimum custody. They could go to a CRC, or they might be able to go out on electronic monitoring, but they're only going to fill one of those roles, right? And we're still going to have space in another. So we have been reviewing inmates constantly since last legislative session, because we heard you. You want people out if it's safe to put them out. The caveat is finding the right people. An example is, we can't put people that are have a charge or a crime of DV out on electronic monitoring. It's in statute. We can't do it. So that takes a chunk of your inmates, and they're not eligible. There are ordinances. We can't put any sex offense folks out in CRCs or halfway houses. Well, it's a municipal ordinance in many places. In some places, we can put felonies. In some places, we can't. Same with unsentenced versus sentenced. So that's that classification unit. They are constantly and always looking at the options and what we can do. Yes, CRCs, the bed cost per day is less, and we would like to take advantage of those. It's just a matter of finding the right inmate at the right time with the right amount of time left on their sentence. You know, you wouldn't put somebody with 5 years left in a halfway house. You would hopefully, it's a transitional, right? It's a transitional move. You want to help them reintegrate back into society. So it's all of those things put together. But yes, we totally support it. And it's just finding the right inmate for the right time.
And Deputy Commissioner, I can't remember, but would you be able to identify yourself for the record?
I did.
Okay,
I
great.
Did, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Another question, Representative Vance?
Thank you. This question is on page 2 of the bill that is beginning on line 15 that says the commissioner may not enter an agreement with a private agency to establish, maintain, operate, control, provide necessary facilities located in the state. Are there agreements currently within the state with private agencies that the department is using that this bill would put limitations on?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I believe that this is, and the sponsor can maybe chime in as well, this is about private facilities as in our prisons. And no, we don't have, that I'm aware of, we don't have any private prisons. We do have private contracts. Our CRCs are through a private contract. My understanding is we're not touching CRCs here. And if as long as that's the intent of the legislature, this is how it is today.
Thank you. Just wanting to clarify that this is legally limited to that.
Representative Fields, do you also have a comment?
Yes, that is correct. The intent of this bill is not to prohibit CRCs that are operated by private entities. That would be disruptive.
Further questions?
Thank you.
Other questions from the committee?
Just a comment. I realize that, I guess, if you're incarcerated for 99 years or more, you're not going to be a guardian, practically. But my concern is just, you know, and we know it's a limited amount of people, but it's just the concern of it being an adult child or a close relative. And, again, I know the department is going to use their discretion on it, but it seems... it seems that there should be some other considerations to be taken into place.
Seeing no other questions from the committee, I'm going to proceed with public and invited testimony. Opening now. We'll start with Kathleen McLaughlin in Anchorage. Ms. McLaughlin, please put yourself on record, state your affiliation, and I believe you're invited testimony by the sponsor, so please present as you see fit.
Thank you. My name is Kathleen McLaughlin. I'm the principal of Restorative and Reentry Services, LLC, which is a national company that advocates for and helps create community-based reentry around the country. Previously, I was the former director of Partners Reentry Center. I'm in support of HB 187, but I would caution you to be a little careful about the language of the amendment. One of the things I just wanted to get out of the way is, as the former director of Partners Reentry Center, we had many, many 99-year sentenced people coming out on parole, to the point where we created a group specifically for them because they have a different reentry plan than people that are short-termers. So using 99 years as a assumption that they're going to do at least 60-some years, in my experience as the director of Partners Reentry Center, that just simply wasn't true. People were applying for and getting parole after 25 to 30 years. I just had 5 points that I wanted to bring up that are supportive of HB 187 without the amendment. And the first thing is that displacement into areas outside of our boundaries discourages reunification. An example of that I just want to give, I've been in New York City participating in a conference, and I met someone who was married to a long-termer, not an Alaska connection, but as a result of him being housed 2,500 miles away from her, she was only able to see him twice a year. And when you think about that, part of reunification, even if you are inside for a long period of time, does not mean you have to be outside the walls in order to be a family member, a parent, a brother, a sister, and to have a support group around you in the community in which you live. The second thing that I wanted to say is that without HB 187, I think you are disassembling healthy communities that have been created within the walls of our correctional facilities. There are currently restorative programs in Spring Creek, in Wildwood, and in Highland that are actively participated, the active participants and the mentors and the healthy parts of those restorative programs are the long-termers. They're the ones that model behavior, are helping run certain programs. In Spring Creek particularly, an example, we have a long-termer who is now teaching a morals and ethics class that has been highly popular, and it was because he was able to model the behavior of a professor who came in to teach nonviolent conflict resolution. those are assets, and long-termers can be assets to the inside the walls if they are provided an opportunity to participate in restorative programs. Third, communities need to meet their soon-to-be neighbors before release. And the Department of Corrections, historically in the last 5 years, has allowed community-based reentry centers, faith-based groups, mentors to go inside the walls in order to get to know and develop healthy relationships with people so that when they release, they have some place to land. And so I think it would be difficult to continue to grow those kinds of programs if the individuals that you are trying to build relationships with were not in Alaska. And that's particularly important for our Alaska Native population who are incarcerated. When you have 38% of Alaska Native population is the representation of the 38% of the full population is Alaska Native, and it's only 18 to 19% of our state population, to not have access to those individuals in order to help them grow with community members would not be a healthy choice, I think, for the state of Alaska. The other two comments I wanted to make is number four is for-profit prisons monetize punishment. They encourage more punitive approaches than they do rehabilitative or restorative approaches. And that has been shown through various studies around the country. And there is a Missouri study which specifically shows that there is an uptick in technical violations and lack of incentivization programs within private prisons, because what is effectively happening is the individuals that are in there, and I'm not saying in all situations, but the ones that have been studied, the person or the incarcerated individual is not a person, it's a product. And so when we look at, well, let's look at the lowest cost alternative, the reason it's a low cost alternative is because most of these for-profit look at a containment model rather than a restorative model. And what the trend nationally is to start steering away from for-profit prisons. That is a trend. So I would encourage Alaska to consider following that trend like many of the other states around the country. And finally, HB 187 provides Alaskans the guarantee that every 4 years, you're not going to have a change in policy that is going to change the cultures within the institutions that have grown over time. I think it is really important for any of the restorative programs, they should not, in my mind, be flipped on and off based on changes in our political structure. I would encourage us, rather than reinventing the wheel every several years, that we look at what we have and we grow what is working and get rid of stuff that isn't. But culture changes within institutions requires time. You can't just flip a switch and say people are going to behave better because of A, B, and C. You have to grow that culture so the people inside view, especially the long-termers, the institutions as a place of safety and home that they want to encourage for others to participate in. So that's the end of my the final thing is I'm a strong advocate of the Alaska Department of Corrections to have the control over choices that need to be made. And I think that when you look at sending people to nonprofit centers around the country, what we as Alaskans do is we lose that local accountability that the Department of Corrections has if they are housing the individuals within the borders of our state. And with that, I'll end my prepared comments, and I'm certainly available for questions.
Thank you, Ms. McLaughlin. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, going to move on to public testimony. A couple of repeat callers, Mike Coons and Palmer. Mr. Coons, if you're on the line and here to testify for HB 187, please put yourself on the record and present your testimony.
Okay, my name is Mike Knudsen Palmer, and I'm speaking for myself. Overall, I oppose HB 187. From what I've read in this legislation, the DOC commissioner is being denied the ability to use sound management practices and putting prisoners where they will cost us the least amount of money, specifically for those with long record of crime and no attempts to correct criminal behavior. I can see keeping and housing first-term prisoners here with strong programs to help them reintegrate back into the community and not return to a life of crime. Moving hardened criminals out of state or into more appropriate maximum security prisons keeps the first-timer away from the hardened criminal. That increases the safety for the first-termer and keeps them from learning the crime trade even more. Second, and something I have yet to see done here or very few other states, when a crime is committed, that is not just a state of Alaska crime, but maybe there's a federal crime in that. We need to turn that suspect over to the U.S. Attorney General's office if that is indeed a federal crime for prosecution. This would save Alaska cost of trial and prison costs. This gets that convicted criminal out of Alaska into a federal prison at the cost of the federal prison system. Sure, we the taxpayers pay for that, but we do that already. These are serious crimes and most likely not something that a person with no criminal history would commit. Thus, they are the problem criminals that have a very poor recidivism rate to begin with. The second idea may be out of the scope of the commissioner of DOC, but why can't this bill be a pathway towards reducing prison overcrowding, prison costs, as well as other means to realistically reduce the recidivism rate in our prisons by using the federal prison system, which the U.S. Attorney General Barr and his predecessor Sessions have told the U.S. Attorney Generals in all the states to start going after these federal crimes. So that I leave open for any questions.
Are there any questions from the committee for Mr. Koons? Seeing none, moving next on the line, David Neese in Anchorage. Please put yourself on the record and present your testimony.
Yeah, hi, this is David Neese calling from Anchorage. I just wanted to say that SB 187 is a good starter for the conversation of how we like to house our prisoners in Alaska. There is a reason we have Spring Creek facility in Seward is because of a judge's decision that we could not house them outside because of the absence of rehabilitation and closeness to family. That was a very expensive lawsuit to lose and cost us several million dollars. My problem with the bill is that you are going to make it very difficult for the Commissioner of Corrections to comply with a judge's order. Because if a judge says your prisons are overcrowded, she does not have the option under this bill to send them out to a different area. So, interesting on that. The other thing is, as an education researcher for many years, I've been trying to get corrections to tell me the educational history or even just the state where the prisoners were educated. I know we have 38% of our prisoners are Alaska Native. Well, that leaves 62% of the population. We know nothing about their history. The assumption that they did not come up here to commit crimes doesn't mean that they didn't start somewhere else and moved up here. We tend to get a lot of end-of-the-roaders up here. So if, as the bill works its way through, an amendment to say, you know, if a judge orders us to reduce overcrowding and our only option is to send them out of state, she has the ability to do that, he or she, the commissioner. And if you also would allow to have real data for you to look at, I was glad to hear she said she was going to tell you how many out-of-staters you have incarcerated, but there is no steady stream of that information. You cannot tell if your schools are pipelines to prisons or if somebody else's schools are pipelines to prisons. So as it's written right now, it's a good conversation starter. It needs some more work. The committee should probably move it out and bring up those questions in the next committee.
Thank you, Mr. Neese. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Next on line, Katie Boats in Juneau. Ms. Boats, please put yourself on record and present your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Katie Boats, and I'm a constituent of District 34. I am, excuse me, I am completely for this bill. I think it will keep family members together, and it will also keep everyone here local in Alaska. If I remember correctly, if we send inmates outside of Alaska, it would actually cost us more money than if we would keep them inside. And as a constituent who has been involved with legislation work, I understand that we are low on revenue. Therefore, if we want to be productive in how we're going to spend our revenue, we should reopen Palmer Correctional Center and we should keep them inside. Also, I believe I've written a written testimony of how I believe we should use the funding on keeping our inmates in the capital, and it'd be a wider choice. As a state, I do not want to be viewed as a weak state who cannot take care of our own crimes and our own inmates by sending people out. We are a strong state, and by that, we need to take care of our own problems. I am more than willing to answer any questions that you guys may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Boats. Next on line, Laura Bonner, please put yourself on record and present your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name's Laura Bonner, and I'm retired, and I live in Representative Shaw's district. I've lived in Alaska almost 50 years, so I well remember the fiasco of private prisons in Alaska and the discussions to bring Alaskan prisoners back. I remember the corruption and the inefficiencies of that time, and we should never go back to that. I personally know four prisoners who were incarcerated in outside prisons. Most of their convictions were because of were fueled by substance abuse, trying to finance them, so on and so forth. I wrote to all of them, both when they were in state and out of state, and they all were more isolated, pressured to become involved with gangs for their protection, had no access to rehabilitation programs or substance abuse recovery programs, and had no visitors while they were out of state. We can do a better job in Alaska. We don't need to contribute to gang recruitment. And while there still aren't enough programs for reentry to the communities, we have made progress in that direction. It's important to continue in that direction instead of private prisons or sending prisoners out of state. Reopening Palmer Correction is a step in the right direction. So I support House Bill 187, and thank you for hearing this bill. I urge you to support it. I'm not so sure about the amendment that I heard because the least cost part of that is a little bit troubling. But thank you for hearing the bill, and I think it's going in the right direction.
Thank you, Ms. Bonner, for your testimony. Any questions from the committee for Ms. Bonner? Seeing none. There's no one else online for testimony. Is there anybody in the room to testify on House Bill 187? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony. For anybody online who just testified who has written testimony, please send that testimony in to hsta@akledge.gov for the sake of House records. Makes their job easier. That takes us back to the bill as a whole, as amended. Are there committee comments? Representative Fields.
Okay. Well, before making the motion on the bill, I did want to thank everyone who was involved with it, including Representatives Jackson, Representative Rauscher, Representatives Drummond, Josephson, Ortiz, Sponholz, Hopkins, Tuck and Clayman, there's been a lot of interest in this subject, and just wanted to acknowledge how many people were instrumental in bringing this bill to this point.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Comments from the committee on HB 187? Representative Vance.
I would like to make a motion that we postpone voting on this at that time. I think there's several areas of concern to make sure that we get the language around the 99 years, the parents' guardianship, the testimony that was given, that we need to get this right. And because it's only has one more committee of referral at finance, they're going to deal with a financial impact. And I think that this is something that we should get right. Even if we give it one more committee hearing, I think would we have the time. We're at the beginning of session. This is a piece of legislation that I think we all care deeply about. And I, instead of fast-tracking this, I want to make sure that we get things right so that we don't impact people's lives in a negative way. That's not our intent at all. So my motion is that we postpone the vote on this today.
Thank you. And just to clarify,
on HB 187.
Noted. I'm not sure there's an actual motion to postpone. I think I know what you're saying. You're asking the sponsor to hold the bill. If you want, you can move to table, which would be a proper motion that we vote on. But I just wanted to clarify that. But your comments are noted, Representative Vance.
Feedback I can make a motion to table if that is the more appropriate.
Well, I would just say let's hold for a second and see if other committee members have thoughts on 187 as amended. It's ultimately the will of the committee. What action, if any, is taken? Before we go to you, Representative Fields. Okay, I see some short. I can't tell. Representative Story, are you wishing to make a comment?
Sure, I'll make a comment. My expectation is the discussion that we had, we would be talking to House Finance Committee member who would be, or he or she would be looking at it and seeing if they needed to make an amendment in the committee. I don't know that, but that's one thought.
Thank you. Representative Fields.
To Representative Vance's point, I definitely don't have concerns about getting it through the House. I think my concern is getting it through the House and to the Senate in time for the Senate to deliberate on it, and I hope have time to take a vote on it before the end, since this is the last year of the session. And just based on another bill that came through this committee last year, the Pioneer Home Bill, once we get to the end of session, it is so hard to get things on the Senate's radar, much less to the Senate floor. So, and trying to move it quickly, I just want to make sure we have every opportunity for this bill to pass. So I guess I am loath to delay only because it has so many more steps before actually becoming law.
Any further comments from other members of the committee?
I respect that you want to get this moving. But from my experience, when bills have moved along to the next time I get to see them, I'm told that I should have taken the opportunity in committee to make any amendments. And I would like to make sure that we get this right. So I make a motion that we table this HB 187 until the next available time slot that the chairs deem appropriate, so that we can get legal advice on the changes that have been made to this bill.
I'm going to object to that motion and then take a quick at ease. There was an objection. I'll maintain that objection. Martha, would you call the roll on the motion to table House Bill 187 as amended?
Yes.
Representative Shaw?
No.
Representative Hopkins?
Yes.
Representative Story?
No.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Representative Fields?
No.
Representative Grace Tompkins?
No.
3 yeas, 4 nays.
The motion to table fails. That takes us back to the bill as a whole.
Thank you. I move HB 187 version 31 LS 1253 /E as amended from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying indeterminate fiscal note.
Object.
There's an objection. Martha, would you please call the roll?
Representative Shaw.
Yes.
Representative Hopkins.
Yes.
Representative Story.
Yes.
Representative Thompson.
No.
Representative Vance.
No.
Representative Fields.
Yes.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Yes.
5 yeas, 2 nays.
The bill passes from committee as amended, and our next meeting is sort of a non-meeting, at least officially. As previously noted, the Juno Reentry Coalition is hosting a reentry simulation. It's at 3:30 p.m. at the Juno Arts and Humanities Council. That's the Jack building with a giant whale mural on it at 350 Whittier Street. So that's going to be 3:30 on Thursday. It's not an official legislative hearing, but you all are invited, and they all are expecting us. And so that's Thursday. The next official meeting will be the successive Tuesday at the usual time, 3 o'clock right here. Yes, Representative Story.
I'd like to comment that I have attended a simulation that the reentry one. They did it for us in the fall for a whole bunch of the community members. It was really an insightful, reflective process, so I highly encourage people to attend. Even if they can only go to part of it, it'll give you a flavor for it.
Thank you, Representative Story. That concludes our business at 4:24 p.m. We are adjourned.